welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and mini-series. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, as part of our Let Motown Roll series, we're recasting Nate's 2022 discussion with Brooks Long about Rick James's autobiography, co-written with David Ritz. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and we welcome back Brooks Long to continue our informal David Ritz book club with a discussion of Glow, the autobiography of Rick James with David Ritz. Brooks, welcome back.
I'm so glad to be back. Yeah, this David Ritz book club series has been a lot of fun, and I don't know if anybody ever had more fun than Rick James.
As Charlie Murphy, or as he told Charlie Murphy, he had too much fun.
Yeah.
Indeed. And so this was a difficult one for Ritz to put together. They'd been talking about it since the early 80s when Ritz was working with Marvin Gaye and met Rick James, who was at the peak of his fame, leading the Stone City Band, quote, carrying Motown. This is a period of time when he was easily the biggest artist on Motown. I think that was about a four-year period from 79 to 83. He was also producing and songwriting, you know, for Tina Marie, the Mary Jane Girls, the Temptations. So, I mean, if he wasn't the straw that stirred the drink at Motown, I don't know who was.
Well, yeah, he definitely, I would, Rick's a funny dude, man. Rick, he's not wrong. And also, this dude has an entertainingly huge ego, which is, you know, why so many people know him today. But there was also the Commodores. And, you know, then the Commodores led to the success that Lionel Richie had. That was all at Motown, too. But yeah, Rick spread out a little bit. His sound spread out a little bit into, he would influence other people. And also he had, you know, the Mary Jane Girls that he was producing, Tina Marie that he was producing, the Temptations he produced. So yeah, the sound of Motown at that time was probably more Rick James than the Commodores, but the Commodores had some big old hits too. And Rick neglects that.
yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up. And this was the hard funk Commodores before Lionel Richie did what he did, which,
yeah,
you know.
This is getting into the three times a lady stuff and all that.
Well, that's true. That's true. He hinted at his future directions while he was still with the Commodores. But back to Rick. I mean, I think that Ritz has a great quote. Between Parliament and Prince, Rick James carried the banner of black pop over that fertile territory known as funk. I think that pretty well sums up what his biggest accomplishment was.
Oh, yeah. This is the sound that he came up with, the sound that he landed on when he finally got his big shot, is sort of in that middle. It's very, it's a lot of George Clinton, a lot of P-Funk in general, particularly some of Bootsy's solo stuff, Bootsy Collins, the bass player's solo stuff. You can definitely hear that in the mix. And you can also hear that this is really, really post-disco music. This is like right after or basically during but leaning out of the the disco era, his sound was really, his sound and Luther Vandross, those were sort of the post-disco sounds right before you get into the Minneapolis sound with Prince.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think you got to mention Earth, Wind, and Fire as another one of his lodestars that...
For sure.
Yeah, that you could almost say it was a cross between P-Funk and Earth, Wind, and Fire. But
when, and Barry White, who he mentions.
Yes, yes, and he loved Barry White. And that's that really comes through in the controversial Garden of Love album, which preceded his massive hit Street... Now I'm blanking on the...
Street Songs, yeah.
Street Songs, yeah, with Superfly on it. But I also... One of the things that really fascinated me, yeah, super freak. One of the things that really fascinated me about this book, because I've watched the documentary and we did a whole episode with Justin Banks on the Tales for the Tour Bus episode on Rick James. And one thing that neither of those really got across as much as this book did was how long his apprenticeship was. Yeah. And how accomplished his apprenticeship was. I mean, this is a guy who was on Motown multiple times, both as an act and as a producer writer. He was on Atlantic, you know, did the whole sign to Atlantic, flew out to Miami, and nothing happened. No album ever came out. He was on MGM and did an album with a group called Great White Kane. Had solo hits in Europe on A&M Records. So he put in a full decade of work and at a pretty high level. I mean, he's literally in a band with Neil Young. He's in a band with multiple members, future Steppenwolf members. He's hanging out with Jay Sebring. He's, you know, we'll get to the whole Helter Skelter connection, but I mean, you know, he's opening up for Yes and Jethro Tull in California. He's playing at a very high level, and it just never came together for him until the late 70s. So, a pretty peripatetic journey to the top for Mr. James.
Yeah, it really is an unbelievable journey. I knew about the Neil Young link, but when I cracked open the book, turns out that was just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And let's go ahead and hear our first song. And this is The Minor Birds featuring Rick James, or as he was known then, Ricky James Matthews, with Neil Young on guitar and Bruce Palmer on bass, who goes on to go on and form Buffalo Springfield with Neil Young. This is It's My Time by the Minor Birds. Was the folk rock sound of a young Ricky James Matthews, aka Rick James, fronting the Minor Birds featuring Neil Young and Bruce Palmer. But we got a little bit before we get to Motown in 1966. He's born in Buffalo and born James Ambrose Johnson Jr. as one of eight children of a Catholic mother in Buffalo, and she worked in the numbers rackets in Buffalo. which kind of sets a tone, you know, for Rick's entire life. Music and the underworld are closely connected, and that's one of the reasons it took him so long to succeed in music, because so many times when he was on his way, when he had the right band put together, he had the financial backing, he was in the hot scene, and you know, there's the popo knocking at the door because he's been up to no good. Can we blame his mother for this or not?
I think it goes both ways, right? There is so much that he was exposed to at a very young age, both creatively and otherwise, and you know, criminally, things like that. I guess you could say that his mom played a part in him getting arrested all the time. But also, this kid got snuck into a bar where the John Coltrane quintet was playing, you know, when he was a small little kid. Like, that'll do something for you.
Indeed. And that was he grew up in Buffalo, but he ran off to New York City for that particular escapade. And so he sees Coltrane at the Vanguard with Eric Dolphy, McCoy Tyner, Elvin Jones. And then he goes and sees Jackie Wilson at the Apollo. And to me, that kind of set both sides of his musical coin right there. I mean, you know, this fascination with jazz and this love for pop R&B, you know, is epitomized by Jackie Wilson. And then he was a big Motown fan when he went back to Buffalo. But he was in a doo-wop group called the Duprés and was a jazz drummer, and claims he sat in with Thelonious Monk, and there's no reason to doubt it. So, you know, one of the most well-rounded musical educations of anybody we've talked about.
Oh, for sure. it's unfortunate that, it is what it is that I keep when I think about Rick James, I keep thinking about Prince. But Prince does have a similar background, but without all of the luminaries. You know, that he had his father was the jazz band leader. And very early on, he was playing a lot of jazz and pop, you know, on the piano as a young kid. They're actually a lot more similar than Rick would probably like to admit.
Yeah, and being stuck out in Minneapolis, Prince didn't have as many chances to connect as Rick did. Although Buffalo is pretty much the hinterlands as well. Let's see, what else I want to say? I think that was pretty much covered his childhood. But one thing that's kind of a red flag for his future fate is that even as a teen, he was dabbling with heroin and bad company. I mean, a lot of his friends were gangsters and got into serious trouble. Although Rick's trouble had more to do with Vietnam than any kind of street escapades early on.
Yeah. It's really interesting. There was, I wish I could remember the name of his mentor, but it seems like he had a mix of bad influences and fairly positive influences going on in his life. But it seems like the underworld influences, plus he was dealing with a lot of racism. I think the integration of schools was really hard for him. And there was also racism going on out of schools, violence that was going on amongst his group of teens that he was a part of, along with his mentor. They experienced some animosity from some hateful white guys. And that sort of hardened him a little bit, where, you know, he was reading James Baldwin and stuff like that. And he could have, who knows, could have been civil rights leader Rick James. And he somewhat was, but it didn't go that way.
No, it did not. And yeah, Buffalo, from the way Rick James tells it, and I have no reason to doubt this, that it's right up there with Boston as far as racist Northeast cities. And he ran into trouble with Italian kids and also I think he called them redneck kids, but just what we would think of as more, you know, Scots, Irish, English types. But it was the threat of Vietnam led him to sign up for the Navy Reserve. And then being young Rick James, he just had a real hard time making those weekend commitments. it's we can laugh about it, because his life turned out relatively well. I mean, obviously he had the highest of highs. But nonetheless, you know, if you were a parent or a big brother, or it would be maddening to watch a kid screw up like this, you know, Yeah. Chance after chance with the Navy. And the whole reason for signing up with the Naval Reserve was so you would stay out of Vietnam. And he did that fairly early on. I mean, I think 63, 64, 65. But he screwed up so bad he was about to be sent to Vietnam. And that's when he went AWOL and ran up to Canada, where this is where the networking really jumps up another level. I mean, he saw some biggies in his time in Buffalo and New York, and even played with Monk, but literally first day in Toronto, he's jumped by a bunch of racists and he's bailed out by two members of the Hawks, Garth Hudson and Levon Helm. Another guy named Pat McGraw goes on to become a big friend, and they become famous later on as the Band. So immediately he's inadvertently networking at the very top.
Yeah. It's one of those things where I want to not believe him, but you also want to not believe that Charlie Murphy stuff true too, and it's all true. Yep. So I can it makes a lot of sense. I think that the Hawks under Ronnie Hawkins and then on their own, I think they were pretty you know, high on the totem pole in Toronto music, and I'm sure the music scene wasn't incredibly big, which is part of the reason why they were there in the first place. So in these like big towns with, you know, small tight-knit musical communities, it's totally possible that he runs right into them.
Yeah, it's a relatively small scene. And I've been reading John Kay of Steppenwolf's autobiography, and he was in Toronto around the same time. And it was a very, very small musical town. And it really does seem like everybody knew each other. And right away, the Steppenwolf connection continues when he meets a guy named Nick St. Nicholas. Steppenwolf had the best band names. Nick St. Nicholas is one of them, and there's another one, Goldie McJohn, but he didn't play with Rick. But actually, he did. Yeah, he's going to be in there in some bands. But he meets Nick St. Nicholas, forms a band called the Sailor Boys based on his naval experience, and has a corny naval uniform thing. But he describes Nick as a slippery cat who started playing with Jack London and the Sparrows, who had a Capitol record contract. But I'm already in trouble with Steph because I was supposed to cue. And so I got to cue our next song. And this is Great White Cane. This is Rick James' second band to be signed to a major label. This is a band on MGM. And this is kind of his jazz fusion early 70s band. This is from the Country Woman Suites. That was Rick James' band on MGM from the early 70s called Great White Cane. That was the Country Woman Suite. And we're still in Toronto, and he's got a band with Nick St. Nicholas, but pretty soon Nick jumps for the Sparrows, which is going to become Steppenwolf. But no loss, because he replaces him with Bruce Palmer, who's going to go on to fame in Buffalo Springfield, and Goldie McJohn plays keyboards with him. Goldie McJohn's going to go on to fame and fortune with Steppenwolf. But at the same time, he's hanging out with Joni Mitchell, Kenny Rogers, Neil Young, David Clayton Thomas, later of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Gordon Lightfoot himself. And one thing I really thought was interesting was he described some of the musical influences swapping that he's doing with his bandmates. And he said, that Bruce Palmer was playing him Laura Nyro records, and while I played them Ornette Coleman. They introduced me to Elmore James and Robert Johnson, while I introduced them to Joe Tex and Pharoah Sanders. And that I thought was interesting, that it was these white folkies that are introducing Rick James to the hardcore blues guys like Elmore James and Robert Johnson. And the Robert Johnson is a no-brainer, because that album on Columbia that made Robert Johnson famous was primarily marketed to the folk community. But I'm still a little surprised he didn't know Elmore James.
Yeah, well, it doesn't surprise me. Yeah, Chicago blues was really local. Not to say that these folks didn't have hits, but their veneration was very Chicago. So it does make some sense to me. There's a good bet that they got to Elmore James through the Rolling Stones, probably.
Yeah.
And perhaps ditto on Robert Johnson. I don't know.
I think Robert Johnson, Bob Dylan got that direct. I guess John Hammond handed him that at Columbia Records, but that was just big with the folkies.
Yeah.
Columbia Records LP. And yeah, Ed Ward said the same thing to me many times, was that those blues guys were seen as a little bit corny by a lot of the younger black artists, and they didn't play the Chitlin circuit. They played clubs and tended to stay local. So yeah, that makes perfect sense. But pretty soon, Rick puts together the band that he thinks is going to be his ticket to fame and fortune. And he hooks up, and this is another thing that I thought was fascinating about this, is Rick is very open about how he cultivated guys with money. That basically, for Rick putting together a project, you needed an image, a name, a band. You had Rick James to start with, so you know you're starting pretty strong. But the money guy is also a key factor that he really focused on. And his first backer was this guy Colin Kerr, who was a quote English would-be Brian Epstein. And the guy, you know, was apparently pretty slick PR artist who got them in the local Toronto papers by sending them to Eaton's department store, you know, in their Beatles wear finery and long hair, and arranged for some teenage girls to chase him through the store, and you know, got some newspaper coverage. And unfortunately, though, Kerr forced him to record two songs by his brother, the Minor Bird Hop and the Minor Bird Song, and that pretty much forced a change in direction. They did some TV teen shows in Hamilton, Ontario, but then they fired Kerr. And then Rick makes a trip to New York City and sees Love and Spoonful and is blown away, which I also thought that was fascinating. And I think I'd read that in another interview and sort of thought that was a joke, because that's something he dropped, you know, at the peak of his funk years in the late 70s. But, you know, Love and Spoonful definitely was the East Coast folk rock band at the time. So, you know, I don't doubt it at all that that was a key influence on him. And then Joni Mitchell recommends her friend Neil Young on guitar, and boom, the Minor Birds go from being kind of a Beatles Stones imitation to a full-on state-of-the-art folk rock band. And then they find another pair of manager funders, Morty Shulman and John Craig Eaton, and that's later going to come back and bite them in the butt. But they sign with Motown, and Barry Gordon is very impressed. That hooks him right up with Mickey Stevenson, the legendary songwriter producer who wrote Dancing in the Streets and produced it on Martha and the Vandellas. So, you know, he has the whole Motown experience. He meets Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, David Ruffin, Tammy Terrell, and then he fires his manager, and that bites him in the ass.
Yeah, it seemed like there was good reason to fire that guy, because they weren't seeing the money. It's unfortunate. Those sides that Motown, I think Motown maybe did put them out. I can't remember. Somehow.
No, they didn't release them until much later.
Okay.
They were about to put out that first single we played, It's My Time. And that's when the manager ratted him out that he was AWOL from the Navy, and Barry Gordy wanted nothing to do with that.
Yeah. It kind of sucks. Because, yeah, Motown was definitely looking to get into the rock and roll angle, and they eventually did with Rare Earth, which I always thought was kind of a corny band. But if you listen to the Minor Birds had something. They really did. Like, that song, It's My Time, which Rick wrote thinking it was, and it wasn't, that's actually a really, really good song. I also think that it's interesting that Rick acknowledges his Rolling Stones influence, and he talks about Mick Jagger, but he says, like, I could definitely sing better than Mick Jagger. I gotta say, Neil Young has said that Rick James wanted to be Mick Jagger, and if you listen to those Minor Birds sides, that's exactly what it sounds like. He sounds like he's been listening to a lot of early Stone sides.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that, and it's also, you know, if you know the history of Neil Young later on, having Neil Young in your band brought a lot of talent, but it also brought a lot of personality issues, and Neil Young, you know, would go on to be Devil, Steve Stills, so in multiple bands. So Rick might be lucky in the end that didn't work out, but it's one of those great what ifs. I mean, because the Motown Machine could definitely have marketed them, and it's just a kind of a question of you know, could they have broken through to white radio? I think they could have. I mean, there's a chance if anybody could have done it, it would have been Motown in the 60s. And that would have been a dramatic shift. But time for Agreed. Our sponsor break. When we come back, we'll talk about what Rick does after his first serious jail time. And so the Minor Birds implode when their manager rats Rick out for being AWOL from the Navy. And then he once again does the same pattern of getting pretty cush deals, screwing them up. And at one point he's looking at like a 5-year prison term. And his mom kind of pulls a hole card out because they've got a cousin, Lewis Stokes, who's a U.S. congressman. And he helps Ricky out and gets him a 5-month stint that he ultimately does. And while he's in jail, he has to find out about the success of his buddies Neil Young and Bruce Palmer in Buffalo Springfield and Nick St. Nicholas and Goldie McJohn and Steppenwolf. But at the same time in prison, he gets really into the Beatles and Miles Davis and discovers Guitar Watson and Larry Williams, which is an album Ed Ward hipped me to. So I thought that was a pretty interesting little mix of influences there. And then go ahead.
Yeah, sure. For sure. Now, he'd grown up listening to Miles Davis.
Yeah, but it's this new era of Miles Davis in a
right.
certain way and pointing towards the fusion that he's going to that really was getting Rick's attention. And he's also talking about the Beatles White Album, but I don't know if the Beatles White Album was out yet because it doesn't come out until late 68, like the very end of 68. So he might have been thinking about Sgt. Pepper or conflating a time when he was into he clearly knows the White Album from talking about it.
For sure.
But he might have had his timelines mixed up a little bit there. But then he heads down to Miami, and another one of his buddies from Buffalo, a guy called Big Red, is doing real well in Miami. And Rick's immediately hooks up with the famous Criterion Studios there, and he claims that he played bass for Sam Moore of Sam and Dave. And I know that Sam and Dave were discovered in Miami. I guess Sam Moore was doing some solo recording there. That's after the Atlantic Stax breakup, and Sam and Dave were kind of lost at sea. He also claims he played with Duane Allman, Steve Cropper, and Cornell Dupree, three of the best, most legendary session guitarists of that era. And, you know, I have no doubt Rick could hang with those guys. I mean, you know, but once again, a successful, a promising career path is pulled out from under him when his buddy Rick Big Red gets busted and Rick has to get out of town.
Wonder why.
yep, indeed. And so then he heads out to L.A. and he's immediately staying at Steve Stills' house. Steve was in Buffalo Springfield with Neil Young and Bruce Palmer. Immediately, you know, I think his first day there, he meets Richie Puré, who was also in Buffalo Springfield, and David Crosby, who was in the Birds at the time and is going to form Crosby, Stills, and Nash, later Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Young with Stephen Stills. He sees love at the Whiskey. In no time at all, him and Johnny Eccles are pals and has a weird run-in with Jim Morrison, who, you know, what's the story that Rick was passed out and he wakes up and there's some weird dude in the lotus position on the floor in the room he's in, you know, bleeding. And it was interesting. He claims that Jim Morrison was a big Motown groupie who found out about Rick's connections to Motown and bombarded me with questions about Smokey and Marvin. I did not see that coming.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that, maybe at the time and definitely a little later, Motown, especially in this era up until the late 60s, early 70s, they're really seen as this corny label to a lot of people who thought they were hip. But if you were a musician and you were listening to the way that, you know, Smokey and Holland Dozier Holland were writing and the way it was all being produced, you were like, I gotta get me some of that, you know. So it doesn't surprise me that Jim Morrison was into all of that.
Yeah, that's true. And it is interesting because from talking to like Ed Ward and Peter Guralnick and some of these critics from that era that I've gotten to meet through this show, they really did see a big difference between Stax and Motown. Like they didn't consider Motown soul. Those guys were
bristle
if you call Motown soul, which just baffles me. But anyway, but in no time at all, you know, Rick kind of has an outside looking in experience in LA because he's hanging out with these guys and he's jamming with them, but he never quite settles into a band in this early period. But he meets a guy named Jay Sebring, who's at the time was like the king of Hollywood hairstylists, kind of the Vidal Sassoon of his day. Most famous now, unfortunately, as one of the victims of the Manson family in Sharon Tate's house. But Rick and Sebring were close, and they shared a lover, a woman named Perfect. According to Rick, he had talked to James into backing him financially, and all he needed to do was go to Toronto. And he knew exactly the musicians he wanted. He flew up there with Perfect and sees this band who are called Opics, Oopicks. But no time at all, the police in Toronto were basically waiting for him because of some shenanigans he had pulled the previous visit to town.
He was wearing the clothes he stole.
Yes. Gifted musician, not a gifted criminal, I have to say, about Rick James. So he draws a 9-month sentence this time. And that, you know, Perfect never called him back. His mom, though, was there for him. And you know, he rides that out and then heads back to Detroit. And this time he works as a staff writer for Motown. Norman Whitfield, who's revolutionizing things with Marvin Gaye and the Temptations right around this time. I wouldn't say, I don't know. I was going to say Whitfield took him under his wing, but I don't know if that's quite right, but definitely.
Oh, that's what Rick says. It checks out. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Because sometimes he kind of bristles about Whitfield, so that I couldn't tell if they were, you know, mentor, mentee, or rival.
Well, he's not the only one.
Yeah. That's true. But he talks about, you know, getting to cut sessions, one session in particular where he worked with the Funk Brothers. And this particular iteration featured Earl Van Dyke on keys, James Jamerson, the great James Jamerson on bass, Pistol Allen, the Shuffle King on drums, and Dennis Coffey. And he produces Out in the Country with Bobby Taylor. And that is our next song. So one of these actually worked out perfectly. So this is Bobby Taylor, Out in the Country, written and produced by Ricky Matthews. You know him as Rick James. And that was Bobby Taylor doing Out in the Country, written and produced by young Rick James, going by Ricky Matthews at the time. And I was really impressed with that. I went through and checked out a number of the songs he wrote and produced at Motown. And it's just interesting that he didn't ever get a hit in this phase. But I guess the competition was just too heavy. And it was also a period of time when Berry Gordy had already moved out to L.A. And that was one of the pieces of advice Whitfield gave him was, you know, this town is dead. The actions in Los Angeles.
Yeah. I think he might have gotten there a little too late, but I would say maybe something that gets a little overlooked by maybe even Rick himself is that Norman Whitfield was going into clubs and listening to the stuff that George Clinton was doing. George Clinton was, I think, briefly writing for Motown, but he was starting to form that Parliament Funkadelic thing. at that time in the late 60s, and Norman Whitfield went straight into the Motown studios and, you know, copped a lot of stuff from that. So Rick might have, you know, secondhand been the second or third person to really be influenced by George Clinton in that way. And that shows up later when Rick has his breakthrough success.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because Rick was so tight with so many of the white rock bands that were influencing Clinton. But they were still doing more folk rock. Like he doesn't mention Hendrix until much later on. It's interesting. So, So yeah, he might've been getting it from Clinton. And another influence in this period that he mentions is Calvin Hardaway, who's Stevie Wonder's brother. And Calvin told Rick James to study Burt Bacharach and Hal David and Jose Feliciano. So that was another swerve I was not expecting. The Motown sage sitting Rick down and telling him which easy listening guys to check out.
Now that makes sense.
It's true. It's true. I mean, that was definitely part of the mix.
Oh man, Black people love Bacharach, by the way.
Hey, white people love him too.
But
we love him. But yeah, it's true. And you don't have that thing that I think that the white boy rockers have where we want to distance ourselves from that stuff because it's not macho enough. I think, you know, I don't see that strain in the black community the way I do with those white folks. But
in spots.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. Run DMC just immediately flashed in my head with their arms crossed and angry. But but he takes Whitfield's advice and goes back to L.A. He hooks up with this guy, Greg Reeves. And they start a group called Salt and Pepper. He reconnects with Jay Sebring, who's totally forgives him for you know, disappearing on him the last time. But almost immediately, Greg Reeves is poached by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And I think anybody who's an aspiring musician could relate to Rick's pain when he goes, brings his buddy out to hang out with his even more famous buddy, his famous buddies, and they immediately poach.
The guy
planning to build a band around.
Here's the thing. You've got a band that already has Stephen Stills, Neil Young, and David Crosby. Like, which one of those people wants to bring another ego into the room?
Yeah.
Although Rick, you know, I'm sure even at this point in time was incredibly talented. From everything that I know, that band was already, you know.
Yeah, it was over. It was too top heavy. I think if Rick had been around a little earlier when Stills was looking for, somebody to be the second instrumental force so they could play live, and that's when he reached back and gets Neil Young. But he wanted Stevie Winwood. And Rick, I think, could have filled that slot, and it would be interesting to see how that would have played out. But when the other big tragedy is that Sebring is then, murdered by Tex Watson and Susan Atkins and the rest of the Manson family. So he loses his backer, loses a friend. And you know, that had to be traumatic because he was invited to the party that night. And, you know, that by all accounts, that was an enormous sea change in the L.A. scene at that point. A total loss of innocence. America's always losing our innocence, but this was one of those moments. But nonetheless, it takes him some time, but he pushes through. He does form his band Salt and Pepper. He ends up opening for Yes and Jethro Tull at the Whiskey. He's signed to Atlantic. He's managed by Phil Walden, who had been Otis Redding's manager, and then goes on to manage the Allman Brothers. And you know, it looks like everything should have worked for that. They're signed to Atlantic. They go to Criterion in Miami to record with Tom Dowd. And, you know, we talked about Jerry Wexler in a previous episode, and this is the period where Jerry Wexler spent a lot of time out on his boat. And you know, Rick James' band Salt and Pepper is just another bit of business he didn't take care of. And so that one fell apart. And I think it's something of this era where there's such a gulf between starting bands and bands that are on the ladder to success. And the discos had arisen, not disco music, but discos, places where people played records instead of listening to live bands. And the economics of that meant that you couldn't make a living as a live band, essentially, unless you broke through and had hit singles and were touring and that whole bit. But the difference between forming bands and getting them going in the 60s and the 70s is enormous, because that bottom tier of the economics has been taken out. So, you know, in another era, Salt and Pepper maybe could have been a live touring band that could have made a living and found another record label. But in the early 70s, that was just a death blow if your record label screwed you around like that and didn't cut a record on you and dropped you. You know, he had to start over from scratch. But he does, forms a group called White Cane. He's inspired by Miles Davis and Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On and What's Going On and Let's Get It On, and signs to MGM. The infamous Mike Curb, who I could go on and on for hours, what Mike Curb did to Dick Dale and Hank Williams III and many other artists. But somehow Rick got this band, got it past Mike Curb, like, you know, a band called Great White Cane. Like, to me, that's obviously a cocaine reference, and somehow it convinces Mike Curb it's sugar cane.
I mean, you're talking about the guy that got a song called Mary Jane to be a hit on the radio.
It's true. But unfortunately, Curb hooked him up with a guy named Jimmy Yenner, who had produced The Raspberries with Eric Carmen, which already, I mean, like, I find very little commonality between The Raspberries and Rick James. And, you know, they tour with B.B. King, go well live, but the record flops, he blames the production, and they got dropped. So, you know, once again, just imagine the work and effort it took to put together not just a band, but a big band. I mean, this is his attempt to do, you know, to reckon with jazz fusion and the kind of production that Marvin Gaye was doing on What's Going On. So, you know.
Yeah, I think this is where, you know, we make fun of Rick's ego, but that high self-esteem is what gets you through putting all this work in for it all to fall apart over and over again. I know a bunch of different musicians that just are great, but they don't quite get the break, or they just miss it or something like that, and they got to do something else. But Rick stays with it, and that's really admirable.
Yeah, it's true. Of course, he had his whole card, which was drug dealing.
Yes.
Yeah. So he's immediately, you know, traveling to India on some business trips. But he also does a little music promotion. He promotes the Pool and the Gang and the Ohio Players gig at one point. You know, admittedly, spend some time being shady, but he gets it back together and does a solo single for A&M, My Mama and Funkin' Around. And let's go ahead and hear that. This is Rick James, My Mama. And that was a young Rick James doing a solo track called My Mama, and flopped in America, but was a hit in Europe. And that's probably the lifeline that kept him going in music, because I really think he might not have kept going if he hadn't had that opportunity to go play in Europe and spend some time in Sweden and a little honey trap he found.
He's always finding something.
that he is. Yeah, we've gone light on his sexual misadventures, but there are plenty of them, and he shares them in the autobiography.
Doesn't seem like he missed one.
No. he got more than his share, I would say. But you know, ends up with a I guess he goes back to Canada and joins a band that's already established called Mainline. It's more of a blues band. But he's financing it by dealing coke, and that's how he meets George Clinton. And according to Rick James, Clinton made him a whole bunch of promises and then never did anything for him. So I don't know. What do you make of that whole encounter with George Clinton?
Well, you know, George, his lifestyle makes it so perhaps he's not Mr. Reliable, but, I think Rick seems to feel that maybe George Clinton was trying to block him and not give him an opportunity because maybe he saw Rick as an oncoming threat. And that's possible, but George Clinton is more like a person who is like going to bring you into his big community. It would be, I'm kind of shocked that George didn't just call him up and say, hey, you wanna be a part of the Parliament Funkadelic thing, just fit in somewhere. He did that with so many different amazing musicians that he just happened to find along the way. That, yeah, it's interesting that that George didn't just bring him into the fold. He could have just forgotten. I mean, as Rick James says, you know, cocaine's a hell of a drug.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, that's one of those mysteries. I guess we could find George somewhere and ask him. I'd be curious to hear Clinton's take on it. And hope somebody asks him while he's still with us. I could see it either way, because George clearly was not intimidated by talent. I mean, he brought so many talented people in, but maybe the charisma of Rick James was so obvious it spooked him. Who knows? But one way or another, it didn't
that
work
could
out.
Be.
It didn't work out, and he continues to put out indie singles, both as Rick James and Hot Lips. He forms a group called Gorilla, and nothing really clicks until he goes back to Buffalo and puts together the Stone City Band, and then everything clicked.
Yeah, that song You and I came out, and that seemed to be a real template. That is, when you think of the Rick James sound, that's it. That You and I single that later is on his debut album, or at least debut under the name Rick James, album Come and Get It, or Come With It, I can't remember, but anyway, yeah, Come and Get It. That song is it, and I think Mary Jane is on there too.
Yeah, it's on that first album.
Yeah, which is a great song too. Not necessarily representative of like the Rick James sound that became influential in this period, in this sort of like post disco period. Apparently the clubs were going crazy for it.
Yeah, it blew up immediately, went double platinum. And, you know, then he immediately puts out another album, Bustin' Out of L7, which is a concept album. L7, which is old 60s slang for losers. There's the 90s grunge band L7, but it was definitely a common term. And then, you know, the Fire It Up album, two albums in 1979. Uh-oh, Preston's at it. Neighbors are getting rowdy. But he puts out Bustin' at L7, and there's a clear pattern. Like, the first one goes to number 13 on the R&B charts, then the next one's number 16. The third one, Fire It Up, is number 34. And then Garden of Love is pretty much a stiff in 1980. It only hits 83 on the U.S. pop charts.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I really like Garden of Love. I gave it a spin, and I'm like, oh, this is cool. He's sort of stepping out a little bit. Rick, I think he did find a formula with that You and I. And he really worked it over the course of those albums. Garden of Love sort of mixes it up a little bit, but still has that formula going. It's a really cool album. It's a really cool transitional album, I'd say.
Yeah, I thought so too. I thought it was him kind of grappling with Gamble and Huff and some of the smoother sounds of disco in that era. And it would have been interesting to see where he would have gone if that had hit. But of course, it didn't. And that's when he comes up with the funk punk angle and street songs, which is, you know, the album and the single Super Freak that he is most known for. And it's the definitive sound. And I see it as a second era, a clear evolution from Come and Get It.
Yeah. Street Songs is just, if there's one, and maybe there shouldn't be just one Rick James album that people check out, but if there is one, that's it. Street Songs is just back to front. So, so good. Really fun. You know, the lyrics are limited to what he's interested in. Yep. Sex, cocaine, and funk. But also he definitely also gets into some political commentary. He talks about police officers, killing people unwarranted in Mr. Policeman, and he talks about ghetto life, where he literally calls out the young girl that introduced him to sex. Like, I think he says in the book it's Nancy, and then he says in the song Ghetto Life, he talks literally about Nancy. He's not kidding. Nope. When he sings that song. And then there's maybe as much as Super Freak in the mainstream, Fire and Desire, the duet that he does with Tina Marie, has never left black radio. It is like the Quiet Storm song, more than Quiet Storm, the Smokey Robinson song, probably. That is 80s R&B ballad, period. He really, really worked that album, and if he never quite hit those heights again, man, he really put a number on it with that one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's something I hadn't really thought about, but you know, when you think about Street Songs, you obviously think of Prince, who's about to cut Dirty Mind. Obviously Prince was paying close attention, but Luther Vandross, I think, was paying just as much attention to Fire and Desire. And like you said, yeah, setting the tone for the 80s. And you know, that's one of the things about Rick James, you know, when you first discover him, like, you know, I mean, it's one thing to discover him like I did casually as a fan or whatever, you know, I had Street Songs back in the day, but going back, you know, as a serious music scholar or whatever, and look at his discography, like, you know, especially compared to, say, George Clinton, who has just got this deep vein of accomplishment with P-Funk, or Prince, who has multiple eras, you know, Rick basically has these two phases, kind of three if you count Garden of Love as mm-hmm. another one, and then he falls off pretty fast. And I think that the explanation is pretty straightforward. He was pretty old when he got called up to the major leagues. I mean, he had so many lost years and so many lost projects. You know, there should have been a Minor Birds album. There should have been a Salt and Pepper album. There should have been multiple Great White Kane albums. I mean, you know, this is a guy who could have, would have, should have been putting out serious work from 1965 on, and he doesn't really get started until 1978. So I think that explains the rather truncated peak era that he enjoyed. And I think that'd be true of anybody, you know, if you're an athlete who was late getting to the major leagues. I'm thinking of Robert Redford as the Natural, you know, Roy Hobbs, the Alameda story, where, you know, he's hurt, shot early on, and he comes back as an older rookie. I think Rick James was in some of that same position, where he had so many failures to connect with the mass audience that by the time he finally did, you know, he was at his peak, obviously in his prime, but wasn't in a position to go on and have multiple phases and recreate himself over and over, you know, like David Bowie or the Beatles or Prince got to do. He really had that one iteration, affected his star persona, and never could get past that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think partially, I think that's all correct. He was not a young man when he really got into the spotlight. And you do wonder, like, if this guy was given the keys earlier, what could he have done? What he did was pretty substantial. And like, there's a whole strain of 80s R&B that owes its success to Rick James. Rick seems to think that one of those people is Prince. I can hear it, but barely. They're more like contemporaries than one influencing another, because they both put out their debut album at the same time. And then, you know, all the way into the mid 80s, they were both putting out albums every year. And I think they were where Rick really rode a formula, because he finally found something that was clicking. Prince was a younger man. He was still trying to find himself. So even though they're starting in the mainstream at the same time, you know, he puts out Come and Get It. Prince puts out For You. But, you know, by the time 1982 comes along, Street Songs gets put out. And that's the best thing, I would say, that Rick James ever comes out with. Yeah. You know, as a whole. And in 82, Prince puts out 1999, which, you know, so he's spreading his wings, and it's becoming a whole other thing. And you might have seen that from Rick James if he had been, you know, given the keys in, say, 1968 instead of 1978. Yeah. But I think that his sound, Rick's sound, definitely was out there. And it's a sound that I remember so much, even when it's not Rick James. There's like, I think about like The Whispers and Shalimar, DeBarge. There's like a whole, there's a whole right strain of R&B that is like this, like, very bass driven, bass riff heavy, forward facing. It's not laid back. Very forward facing and kind of aggressive post disco funk that that I think it still works today. And I think because it was 1978 when he came out with that album, and he was like a little more on the aggressive end, and he was kind of like the bad boy of R&B. He called himself punk funk, you know, this like the year before in 77 was like the big punk rock explosion. In Attitude, maybe you can hear some punk stuff going on, but I'm thinking maybe he just said that to,
I think, make it's more street songs that was when he really started adopting the punk funk thing, and I think you can hear it more in that album than stuff.
I think he was talking about that pretty early. But in Street Songs has some of that. I definitely think you could play Super Freak and then play some Talking Heads and then play some B-52s, and it would kind of make sense.
You can, and we did, I can tell you. we were the jukebox at the bowling alley in Borger, Texas was dropping Super Freak, Rock Lobster, Back to Back, and Billy Squire. You know, It definitely was of its time and was at the forefront of its time in a way that Prince was not until 1990, to me at least. And I was pretty backward on R&B, I got to say, at the time. But I can remember hearing a tiny bit of Prince in that era. But Rick James was all over the place. I mean, it was Rick James and Joan Jett back to back throwing down on that jukebox. And yeah. Super Freak could hang with I Love Rock and Roll any day of the week. Any final thoughts before we wrap?
I'd say I think a lot about unfortunately, I think a lot about Prince when I think about Rick James, and I think it's important to separate them for a number of reasons. You know, I talked about how they released their debut albums the very same year, but Prince, you know, Rick also thinks that Prince stole the idea for the Mary Jane Girls and then did Vanity Six and what was the other, Apollonia Six.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I don't think it is. No, because George Clinton had already done that with Parlette and the Brides of Funkenstein.
Yeah.
I think that there is an edge to Rick, which is maybe justified because he didn't get on MTV and Prince did. And there, he, you know, had Prince open up for him on tour. And he says, you know, the way Rick tells it, you know, Prince just couldn't connect. Yeah, Prince just couldn't connect with anybody. That's not what I've heard. I've heard from people who were at those shows on the tour that they came really excited for Rick James and they left being like, who is this dude Prince? And I think there is some edge that Rick really feels like he should have been where Prince was, thought about the way that Prince was. And if he had that break back in 68, that's probably the way we would have thought about him. We might have thought about Rick James and Sly Stone in like they might have been in the same sort of conversation. But that's not what happened. And Rick, you know, got there a decade later, and then he was also kind of sliding into his own addiction as Prince is just rising and rising and rising, and has not in you know people's estimation really stopped at all. People are just you know starting to really understand what his artistry was all about. But that guy lived in the studio, whereas Rick lived in the street.
Yeah, and it's entirely possible if Rick had gotten his break in 1968, he would have been, you know, the funeral would have been the same year as Jimi Hendrix. So, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so all we have is the world we lived in, and it's one in which Rick James enjoyed a fair share of triumph, I had to say. Maybe he didn't reach those very highest levels, the Sly Stone, the Beatles, the Prince levels, but he was up there and he got his licks in. And so for Brooks Long, this has been Nate Wilcox, and we've been discussing Glow, the autobiography of Rick James.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate holds a Let It Roll seance and summons up the late Jack Palmer to discuss his book, Vernon Dalhart, first star of country music. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.